Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, and we're back for episode 13 of Digital Divination. So, Ron, you had a big announcement here last week at PAX Online.
Yeah, exactly. That was the that was a lot of fun. It was PAX Online is the virtual experience for PAX Unplugged. I think I heard somebody say they probably just should go with PAX Plugged. But they went with PAX Online. Anyway, the big news was our announcements for the last half of 2021 on the Pathfinder side, at least some of those. The in-world area that we're going to be exploring is sort of our version of Fantasy Africa. It's called the Mwangi Expanse, and we are coming out with a huge book, like 300-plus page book, on the Mwangi Expanse and all of the people there and the different sort of nations and stories and monsters. And then along with that, the thing that I've been working on, you know, very, very closely, very deeply for the past several months now, and will be doing so for many, many more months, is an adventure path that takes place there in a magic school. It's the oldest magic school in our world in the Mwangi Expanse, called the Strength of Thousands Adventure Path. I was very excited to be able to talk about that.
Yeah, that's neat. You know, it's we had talked a couple months ago offline how you were having some internal discussions about how to develop and present this, basically this Fantasy Africa campaign. What brought that about in Paizo?
Yeah, it's two things that have come together. It's first a real serious desire for us to explore sort of this part of the world and in order to present it. And secondly is the different types of adventures that we put, the different types of stories we put into our adventure paths. A classic story is like the magic school story, where you start out sort of as novices of this magic school and you become sort of experts and end up saving the school. That's a good, solid, traditional story that we could have set in a lot of different schools, but these two points kind of came together really well because our biggest, oldest magic school, the Magambia Magic Academy, is in the Mwangi Expanse. Now, part of the reason we hadn't touched some of this before, I think, is because most of us at Paizo are a bunch of white guys, or, you know, white people generally. And I think there's some trepidation on, would we be sort of co-opting or misrepresenting a black culture in our world, especially in this day and age of increasing awareness about Black Lives Matter and social justice movements and some real problems in the real world of white people speaking over or on behalf of black people. That was a real serious concern in addressing this. And the way that we went about it was to get as many black voices as we could in this, black people of color of all kinds, but black authors in particular, we wanted to make sure to have their voices. There's a large number of people of color in the freelance RPG writing space that we've actually been sort of working with for a long time, but being able to sort of put them sort of front and center at this, let it be sort of their voices and the way they want to tell the stories and the way they want to present the Mwangi Expanse. And I think that has been a big success. It's a lot of work because it's kind of easy for me to rely. It's kind of easy for any of us in Paizo to rely on an existing stable of authors. But when you look at the existing stable of experienced authors and they're all white, well, you not only need to expand, but you need to make sure you've put into place the time needed to help build up these authors that are people of color so they become part of the regular stable, right? That's an investment of time, and time is one thing that that we're sort of short on and have to sort of shoehorn in. And making the time for that, making that important, was one of the things that we really prioritized to get these voices.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I'm excited to see that. One of the things that, you know, I've noticed, I've been to a lot of conventions the last couple of years, and they are very monochromatic in terms of player base. And I've only met, I think, only one black author. I met him at SkullCon. He did one of the quest packs for Starfinder. So I'm excited to see more and more people of color involved in any project. Be really cool to see more in Starfinder too, though.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I know that that's something that we are pushing even on the Starfinder side. I know that it might have been Alien Archive 3. One of the assignments that Starfinder had, where they reach out. The developer reaches out to people internally to say, hey, here's this book we're doing. If you're interested, let me know. And we'll give you kind of whatever you want to write, however many words you want to write. And then we'll take it as a call to sort of external freelancers in order to do the rest of it. Starting with Alien Archive 3, I think, the developer sent out an internal email, but basically warned us and said, I am very interested in getting people that haven't been represented in writing before as part of this book. So if you're interested in writing, let me know, but you're not going to be able to just pick and choose as many words as you want, because I want to make sure that we're giving some experience and some voices to other people who perhaps have been marginalized in the tabletop RPG space and get their thoughts too. And I was really pleased about that. I think for Alien Archive 3, I only ended up writing one monster because there was so much opportunity spread around. So it's definitely going on in Starfinder as well. It's just a little more front and center in Pathfinder because we have a Asian, or sort of our fantasy Asia focused adventure path, followed by a fantasy Africa adventure path. So it's very sort of focused on Asian representation and black representation, people of color throughout.
Yeah, it's in Starfinder, you have alien races of all type, and we don't really have a good representation of that, I think, in the U.S. So
yeah, I think they wouldn't be admitting it if they were, right?
That's,
I can write like a human. Yeah. Please give me the human writing job.
So tell me, we've been suffering from smoke up here from the wildfires, both in Eastern Washington and coming up from Oregon. How's the smoke around your house?
Oh my goodness, it has not been very good. I guess the smoke itself is doing fine.
but the people dealing with the smoke, not so much. Yeah,
not so much. We're well practiced at hunkering down anyway because of the pandemic. Yeah. But my son in particular, who is 9. He needs exercise. He gets sort of anxiety issues, and sometimes his sort of anger sort of ramps up. And we have seen since he was even very little that regular and consistent exercise helps him regulate. And so we go out. I mean, and he's gotten so good. I'm so proud of him. We'll go on like 15-mile bike rides, which he can do because he's kind of done this sort of work with us and this exercise with us. But we don't want to have him or ourselves out in the smoke. And so we're kind of keeping everybody at home. And I mean, the fact that he has been, you know, a lot more irritable and kind of lashing out at me and his mom and his sisters. I mean, it shows that outdoor activity is just so vital for him in particular, but the whole family. And I'm really looking forward to be able to get back to that probably within the next couple of days.
Yeah, I'm up here in Camino where I'm at right now. It actually is in the green. It's below 50 for the
count. My goodness. No, we're still like 120, 130 up here.
Yeah, but I think everywhere in the area is supposed to get down by Sunday. So we're hoping. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, so last time I got to surprise you with a question.
That's right. Topic. That's right.
So today the tables are turned.
All right. So I've got a question for you I'd like to hear you talk about. We've been kind of touching a couple of times on sort of difficulty and maybe even encounter difficulty in Starfinder. Here's my question for you. What are the toughest fights you've been involved with on either side of the screen in Starfinder where you thought it was pretty likely that the players just couldn't win? And what was similar about all of those really difficult fights?
Oh, so that's the remembering the fights, that's a little bit easier. What's similar is a little more challenging. So I can think of two offhand where I could have, should have had TPKs, but kind of massage things a little bit so they survived. Now, there's going to be some spoilers here.
Okay, so fair enough.
I'm going to apologize in advance. So the first one was actually early on, and we played through this, and then I ran it again for my home group. It was the final boss in Dead Sun's Book 1, Incident Absalon Station, that Gargrigal thing, whatever it is.
The drift monster.
Yeah. The thing with the humongous mouth and wings and stuff like that. And, you know, basically that was designed for players that were at level 2. And that particular creature had regeneration, hit really, really hard, was hard to hit. I mean, there's for level 2 characters, that was a really, really challenging fight. And, you know, basically in its strategy was like to go after one character and like finish it off. I think that was the other thing that was written in there. And so rather than spreading around the damage, it really focus on one person and take them down and then go to the next. So that's the first one. The second one, it's actually a bit more recent, and it's in Starfinder Scenario 3-01, which is, you know, I've run it like 3 times, and I should have this name, but let me look at it really quick just to have it right. Come on. It is, Crashdown. Yeah, Crashdown.
Oh, okay.
So it's called Crashdown, and it's a 1-4 scenario. And the players, there's one part when they're on rafts, and they're going down a river, and they get attacked by a giant river eel, basically.
Okay.
And the CR on that or something is just so high that they have a hard time, especially it's a 1-4, so low-level characters. Even at the lower level, the creature is large. At the higher tier, 3-4 tier, it's huge, and it just comes in and just destroys them. Again, and it primarily focuses on one thing and takes it down and goes to the next. And then the third one I can think of that was very challenging, I wasn't as worried about a TPK, but I'm seeing a theme here. It was Starfinder, said the final scenario for Starfinder Season 2, it's 2-24, and I can't remember it offhand, precisely the name in there. But the final boss in there, oh man, I played it when it first came out with my level 12 operative, and it crit me for all my stamina and half my hit points in one blow.
So it's not that it focused on it, just that it hit really hard when it hit.
It hit really hard when it hit. And had it focused on me, it would have taken me down. Now I ran it, and one of the strategies that I like to do when I'm playing the NPCs is I look at who's going to be really dangerous. And oftentimes it's like, oh, those casters are really dangerous. So oftentimes my NPCs, if they're not casters, will go to take out a caster. Mm-hmm. And so when I was GMing this, I saw, oh, there's a caster there. I'm going to go ahead and spend a full round action, do a full attack on that caster. And I just dropped him down to nothing. You know,
well, they don't have the defenses usually, so
right, and didn't give him a chance to get his spells off and, you know, the buffs or whatever he was going to do. And he was very sad. He was very sad about that. Basically, to be, you know, kind of taken out of the boss fight right at the beginning. And again, this is just the strategy I had adopted for this particular character. I'm going to go and take down something, you know, if I can right away with a full attack, and boom, just did it. So looking across the three of those, so it seems to me that if the particular creature doesn't distribute its damage across others. Oh, and I just remembered one more too. Yeah, there's another scenario I ran. I actually ran at PaizaCon, the last in-person one we had. It was a 7-10. Oh man, this was a really scary one because they had a boss that was really pretty challenging, but the party can take it down. But once it goes down, it transforms into a demigod. Oof. And and that thing, it does a multi-attack that, you know, one round attack would basically take down a character. And especially after they got fighting its previous form, it's really, really hard to get past it. So again, huge amount of damage. And with a multi-attack, typically all the attacks are focused on the thing that's closest to you. And then I actually thought of another one. Oh, yeah, there's one of the early scenarios in Season 2 of Starfinder. Actually has a creature that's designed not to be fought.
Okay.
Yeah, it's this nanite golem that basically... So I played it at Origins last year, so the last live one, and I had John Compton in my group, and we were playing, and we're going to wait for this thing to form up and then attack it. And we had three players plus pre-gen of Obaziah, and so Obaziah goes and takes it, and she gets crit, loses an arm, and at this point we realized we should not attack this thing. And then when I've GM'd it, I have to give players a whole lot of foreshadowing about how big and scary and dangerous this thing seems.
So they all do just the same thing.
Yeah, because they all want to sit there and fight it toe-to-toe, and I'm thinking they're all going to be dead in one round, you know, two rounds at most. And so have to really talk it up and make it look really fierce. And so one person will maybe get slammed around, then they decide to run. So it looks like concentrated damage, regardless of the level. So these levels have ranged from level 1 all the way to level 12, which is about the highest that we have currently until Devastation Arc, you know, came out. So I guess that's a higher level now. So yeah, that's kind of what my experience has been as a player in GM.
Huh. All righty. Well, that's good for me to know from somebody that's as played as many different types of adventures as you have, because when I'm doing my writing, I want to keep in mind what feels hard and what doesn't feel hard. Right. You see what I mean? Because that's valuable for me to be able to know, to be able to signal when something could be sort of the real tense fight, when you'd want to have the dramatic music in the background, for example.
Well, you know, for a lot of really challenging creatures, you know, a really big boss isn't so scary, except if it, you know, if it gets a really lucky shot early on, then that can really, really scare you off. Or if it just does so much damage as part of a regular attack early on, you know, the reality of that, once it hits you, you know, your fighter goes up there, goes toe-to-toe, or your soldier goes up toe-to-toe and just gets hammered down, then all your other soft targets are saying, whoa, we need to stay back at range and do things like that. But the other thing that can be really challenging, and it's not one big individual, but it's like a whole bunch of creatures that are all attacking you. And if your team doesn't do a good job of focus fire, because they'll just whittle you away. And then there's some specialized attackers that can tend to be difficult for parties when they're not prepared. One of them I've seen in a couple encounters, including with us, is a swarm. We don't have, typically player groups don't have everybody with the ability to damage a swarm. Yeah. And sometimes they might have nobody. And that's a real challenge. And then,
yeah, because then they become, I mean, they're better than they used to be. I think in a lot of earlier editions of the game, they were just literally unkillable if you didn't have the right options.
Well, and now what I see in at least a lot of scenarios and APs is, you know, you'll see people, the authors dropping grenades, dropping line weapons, dropping area effect weapons, you know, so they at least have some. And then the other thing, and this caught us in Dead Sons, was if they're incorporeal.
Because that's probably my number one toughest fight was, without going into as many spoilers, right? A fight against a person that is blinking. So they've got kind of the defenses of incorporeality where you're going to miss them. And they're invisible and they've got a bunch of tough thugs with them and they cast a lot of debilitating spells. And you know where I'm talking about, I think.
You know, and so, you know, again, part of it is, you know, as a player, I've learned, right? So I always have a weapon with a Ghost Killer fusion on it. And so, you know, whenever we, like, even in our Dawn of Flame one, right? So we run into something, I got that because I know that something's going to happen and we need to be able to do damage. The Swarm one, that's tougher for me because unless I'm, you know, unless you're doing something that carries heavy weapons or you're a caster that does area effect spells, there's not a lot of, you know, small arms. There are some, but not as many that have a kind of area effect type of damage that you can use.
Yeah, you want to be prepared for a lot of those things. When you talked about how an early hit, like an early crit or a very effective attack that a monster makes early on can be a little bit demoralizing, make players sit up and take notice. That reminded me of something from the moving the other direction. Kaleidoscopic Doom, we called it. Back in the third edition days, I was big with a lot of my friends in the Living Greyhawk campaign. And so we went to a lot of different cities, a lot of different states, playing a ton of organized play with a lot of different people. And we had a friend of ours who had some sort of prestige class with an ability called Kaleidoscopic Doom. And it was very limited. You could only do it once. And it had this really impressive display of sort of offensive power, but then you were kind of tapped out and couldn't do it, you know, basically for the whole rest of the adventure, right? But he learned early on, the very first time, very first round of the very first adventure, he opened up with this Kaleidoscopic Doom and did such incredible damage to, like, all of the bad guys that the GM just got deflated. And for the rest of the session, when a fight would kind of start going a little bit our way, he'd kind of hand wave and be like, oh, well, you've got that kaleidoscopic power, so I'm just going to hand wave it. Or these guys jump you, but they're not really tough. You'll be able to take them, you know, we're just, you know, moving on. And afterward, we were sort of talking about it. It's like, you broke the GM, right? you had such an overwhelming display of power at the beginning that he sort of, without looking deeply into the rules, right, he's sort of assumed that we could give that level of power consistently and ran it with that assumption that we'd be able to overcome anything that he threw at us, which wasn't the case, but that became almost like a strategy, especially because Living Greyhawk had a little more competitive play sometimes, to try to get people thinking, I can, with this one overwhelming strike early on, I am showing you, oh, I'm a force to be reckoned with, even though I can't actually do it a lot. It's like an animal that tries to look big to avoid predators.
Right.
And so the phrase that we had for that was Kaleidoscopic Doom, named after this one power. But the concept kind of goes across, which is making people at the table think that you can consistently put out substantially greater effect than you actually can. And so when you're describing doing that from the other side, that's Kaleidoscopic Doom from the GM side, right? A crit comes in, and sure, as a player, you know that crits aren't going to happen all the time, but if this monster's dealing out 60 points of damage every time it swings, you just don't want it to swing. You're going to have a hard time thinking that you can even overcome it.
Yeah, you know, in that particular instance, I was crit for over 100 points.
Oof.
Yeah, and it was like, I didn't know what its regular attack would be, but I figured it was close to half. And I'm looking at my stats. I'm thinking, if I get hit by regular attack again, I'm dead. I had to run away. It's like, you know, that's run away and figure out a new strategy. You know, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned this kaleidoscopic doom, and you know, as a GM, I'm thinking, man, challenge accepted. How am I going to work around that? I'm not just going to give up. Come on. Oh, yeah. Well, that works here, except now you're in a bronze-lined room that reflects all the damage back on you. Oh, yeah, go
now
ahead.
Now what are you going to do?
Yeah, you know, something like that. Now, you know, that said, I'm trying to think of, other, way overpowering things. You know, you think of like ninth level spells like Wish and stuff like that. You know, you can't just make somebody dead, but, they're designed to be like super powerful. We don't have people spamming Fireball and Starfinder. You know, there's not a lot of big spam spells. There's big limits on it. There is a capability to spam Magic Missile now. You can get there's a special feat that allows you to like basically have endless supplies of it. Scott's got this in our other campaign. But the damage on it, you know, especially as you get to higher level, who cares that you can do, 3D4 plus 3, against creatures that have 250, 300 hit points.
Yeah.
It'll take you forever, right, to do it. But at low levels, fourth level or whatever, when you can start picking it up, it's like, wow, that's a really cool thing. One of the things I noticed in Starfinder, though, is there's not a lot of single source points of damage. From anything. Now I had I ran the same campaign where I had a really hard time. I ran that for some, the one where my operative got crit so bad. I thought, oh man, I'm going to run this for my home group, and I've actually run it 3 or 4 times now because it's a 9 to 12. It's kind of like the highest level that we had for the scenarios, and I ran it for the home group. And well, they had two ranged soldiers in it that had Soldier's Onslaught, and they would just do 3 attacks per round, and they had such high bonuses that they were doing like 120 to 150 points of damage per round. They just took everything apart like nothing.
Well, that's not even a kaleidoscopic doom, because they could literally keep doing that every round.
Right. Now they had to hit, and it was across 3 attacks because they were getting multi attacks with it, so that kind of reduced their chance to hit. But man, both their characters, there's a husband and wife team, both their characters were designed to optimize, that one particular build and skill set. So it was truly a tremendous amount of damage that they could do. Other than that, you don't see a lot of heavy single round damage dealers. Usually, it's consistent damage over time. You get a big crit, it's really big. Same with kind of the monster end, they're these creatures, like the one creature I was talking about that was in a 7 to 10, it's called Herald's War. Basically his multi-attack, he had 6 attacks that he could do per round, and they all could hit pretty substantially. So if you got hit by even 3 of them, it would really take you down. But still, it wasn't a single attack, it was just a single round of action, but not a single attack.
Yeah, I think in Starfinder, a lot of the really powerful abilities from a design perspective are locked up behind must spend a resolve point to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder whether there's something along the lines of sort of collecting the powers that take RP to use, throwing those out, sort of, a couple of them in quick succession, and then knowing full well you couldn't do much more, right? You need to save your RP for saving your life, for example. But to the extent, maybe it's not overwhelming damage, but some sort of overwhelming effect. Wow, look at all this cool stuff this person can do. Well, you're doing it with an actual really limited resource.
Yeah,
maybe there's something there in Starfinder.
Yeah, you see that, monsters have RP and they actually don't save it to stabilize for some reason.
that's a good point.
But usually you don't see them with more than 4 or 5 RP points. So they'll have the capability to do something 4 or 5 times. And the reality is most battles in Starfinder don't last more than 3 or 4 rounds, though I've had a couple last a really long time if both sides are pretty inept at hitting the other. So,
and that's actually part of the design rules. If you're designing a creature that requires RP, the rules say how many RP to give them, and it's not very many. It's like 1 CR divided by 5, plus some small number. So it's not very, but 3 and 4 is kind of about as most they get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting. So on the Pathfinder side, what's like the most dangerous thing that you've ever run into?
Oh my goodness.
As a player, developer, or GM.
This has got to be from both a player and a GM. and it's, let me put it a little more conceptually, right? It's stuff like Medusas and basilisks and liches. It's things that classically have what they call save or die effect.
Right.
Or sometimes they say save or suck, because you're not maybe not dead, but you're really out of things. Anything that can inflict fear. I was playing a game with my a fairly long campaign with my wife and some other friends. My wife's character was a barbarian, and I think I was a wizard or something. Anyway, her barbarian absolutely was tuned to, she could kind of one-shot just about anybody that was of a reasonable challenge. But she did that at the expense of her will save, and her bane was anything that caused fear. Because if something makes you run away for 1d4 rounds, well, she's going to go. She's a barbarian. She's fast. So she will be totally gone in those 1d4 rounds and then need to spend this 1d4 rounds going back. So anything that put her out of the fight for any number of rounds from a fear effect that made her run away basically doubled the effect. And I remember there were several fights where it would have been kind of a pushover with her, but because she blew a will save against something scary really early on, we had to do basically 6 or 8 rounds of a fight without her. And, you know, it was really touch and go for a lot of that. And I think it's because the sort of save or die kind of effect, the save or suck effect. And I know that Starfinder, as a design principle, got rid of a lot of those. And then Pathfinder 2nd Edition, that's one of the things they realized was a success about Starfinder. And they got rid of a lot of the sort of save or die effects. Instead, both systems give you things that will degrade you over time.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do is you want to spend your resources on fixing yourself before you become paralyzed or digitized or immobilized or something like that. Or you've got the ability to make a save every round to overcome it and then get back in the fight. So it's not an excuse for the player to kind of shrug and go, all right, well, I blew that saving throw. I guess I'm going to go, you know, make myself a pizza or something. Mm-hmm. But those types of things, it's easy to lean into an encounter where the villains have a lot of those sort of save or die effects. And those become really overwhelming. They're one of the worst things that I saw. There's a monster called a Bodak in 3rd edition, an undead monster that had a gaze effect. If you started within 30 feet of it, you make a fortitude save or you die. I mean, easy. Your soul's just sucked right out of your body. And there was encounters I saw that had like 8 of these creatures in a little room. So it's like, oh, your turn's starting? Make 8 fortitude saving throws, and if you fail any one of them, you are dead. I mean, that's... really?
Wow.
So that leaning into those save or die effects was something that made for some of the most lethal encounters that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, those are the same things I was remembering. I haven't played a lot of Pathfinder, but I played D&D before, and those are the things that really would really scare us as well, you know. Yeah, I don't see a lot of that in Starfinder. I mean, there are things, you can get paralyzed, but you can make a save each round. Fear effects are still there. I had my operative, who's very fast, basically got feared on by some creature. And again, it was, you know, running for 8 rounds and running back for another 8. And so,
yeah,
of course, everything's done by then. And they're back at home eating dinner, you know, by the time you get back. So,
well, one of the things that Starfinder has that is a really good sort of stopgap is they've got intermediate rules for stuff. They've got like the shaken condition, right? So you've got, all right, you're a little bit afraid. And that's really good, because in the earlier editions, the only way they really had to represent fear was you're running. Mm-hmm. And now there's been this sort of other conditions you can put on people. So, you know, you're not just totally out of the fight. Maybe you're fatigued from something. Maybe even you're exhausted from something, but you're not out. And so I like the fact that there's the conditions to be able to play with.
Yeah, and there's a lot more conditions as you get to higher level. That's one of the things I noticed in Starfinder. And it takes a while for the players to realize they need to start bringing condition removal with them in scenarios. And so, you know, sometimes one player, you know, an envoy or a mystic will have something, either, you know, envoys to suppress the condition, mystics to remove it. But that doesn't really come into play until you're, you know, getting up 7th, 8th, 9th level, where those become more critical. And again, because they're not totally debilitating, oftentimes, you know, groups will just do without them and everybody else finishes them off as I try to fight through this thing. I imagine as we get to even higher levels, though, that those things, having mitigating abilities at those higher levels, become much more important.
Yeah, I think so. And then having the types of abilities that are very versatile in the things you can mitigate, mm-hmm. right? Where you can get rid of lots of different things. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got remove affliction, which is actually kind of a low level in order to get rid of some things, and remove condition. But yeah, all those things require lesser and greater versions because there's a greater menu of stuff that you're able to get rid of. That mm-hmm. becomes really important. That flexibility is what's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really like the envoy being able to suppress those as well, you know. So, you know, the envoy is like a mystic light in a lot of things, being able to get back stamina and suppress some conditions. You know, it's all the more temporary things, and then your mystic is about all the life or death kind of things, you know, the more long term.
Right. Stuff, right. Like. Yeah, if you've got a disease, you don't want to talk to your envoy, you want to talk to your mystic.
Yes, for sure. All right. Well, I have a question for you.
Alrighty.
Actually, Ryan has a question, and I'm just going to repeat it.
So you're proxying his question. Alrighty.
Yeah, so Ryan asked, if you were in charge of a Lost Omens style campaign setting for Starfinder, what would it look like?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I frankly think it would look a lot like the books that we have, right? I would want to examine the Pact Worlds in detail. I would want to examine Near Space and the Viscarium in detail. I would like to give books with a lot of different in-world flavorful character options, right? So a lot of the products that we currently have, the Character Operations Manual, Near Space, the Pact Worlds book, which is how your character fits in. One thing that Lost Omens has done that with a great deal of success, I think the last time I checked this, the Lost Omens Legends had something like 22 reviews, and they were all 5-star reviews. A product that just presents people, both historical and living, in the setting, and really brings to life, these are sort of the other characters that you can meet or ally with or have as your enemies. And it really sort of brings these people, to life in the world. I think something like that Starfinder would do really well with. And being able to talk about, all right, well, you know, who is the head of the Starfinder Society? Who's the head of the stewards? And what might it be like to ally with them? Or what might an adventure be like to be in opposition to them? I think that there is not, if I could sort of combine some of the streams a little bit, I was recently reading through a 5th edition book, Mythic Oddities of Theros, which is sort of their Greek-themed setting. That pulls from a Magic the Gathering set, a couple of Magic Gathering sets that have done really well. But one of the things that impressed me about the Mythic Odysseys of Theros book is they have like their 15 gods or whatever, and they've got a big spread on each saying, who is this god? What are they about? What are their followers like? What are adventures that they might inspire? And what type of adventures would be going up against them or their followers? Mm-hmm. That, I think, is a really good way to break down major NPCs in a lot of settings, right? So it's going to be, all right, well, who's the head of the Android Abolition Front? What might their followers do? What might adventures where you're doing things for them be like? And what might adventures be like where they're an antagonist? Not necessarily a bad guy, but they're not bad necessarily, but they could certainly be an antagonist. They could have interests counter to the parties. And I think that kind of deep analysis of NPCs allows not only for a bigger view of the world, but allows for some really exciting seeds for adventures that I think could be a really big hit. That's the one thing from the Lost Omens line that I think Starfinder could really benefit from.
Yeah.
So, how about you? What do you think?
I don't know much about the Lost Omens line, so I don't know what's all in it, to be honest. I know it's a kind of a big deal, but one of the things that, you know, I got to thinking about as you were talking is, you know, it seems like having a more detailed, like a Pack Worlds Gazetteer, of places and people and things, you know, so going into the detail you're talking about would be kind of interesting. I mean, we have the Packworlds book that gives a broad overview, but nothing that really gives you a deep dive into, in particular, like one of the things I think we should be doing is like a stewards based adventure, you know? And I think that would be really cool to have an AP around that, a book about the stewards, you know, maybe some custom, you know, stewards equipment, stewards armor, stewards weapons, you know, stewards, whatever it is, you know, try to build something out around, you know, that particular group that we know exists already. And sounds like they could do a lot, you know, who are the outlaws that they're going after? How do they, you know, how do stewards deal with outlaws when they catch them? You know, like none of our starships, well, actually some of our starships have brigs, but a lot of them don't have brigs, you know, and then what do you do with them when you get them? You know, so oftentimes when we're playing society play, it's you capture somebody and you turn them over to the stewards, you turn them over to Starfinder Society. And now we know the Starfinder Society actually has a secret Guantanamo Bay type of holding area underneath the Lorespire complex. I don't think it's as bad as Guantanamo Bay, but it's like a very secretive, super secure complex. I don't think they torture people.
Supermax prison.
Supermax underneath. Which I was, when that came up, it came up in some scenarios, I was really surprised that they went that direction. Because I didn't think Starfinder
in the modern day. I mean, yeah. Especially not just in the Starfinder world, but considering sentiments in the modern day about policing and imprisonment and so on.
Yeah, no, they didn't go in. I mean, this is where they had VIP guests and kind of secured special relics and I guess certain dangerous criminals. But it was really, for me, it was kind of odd that that was not a direction I thought the Starfinders would go into. I thought that's a stewards thing, which is, why not just put all that thing, okay, you go to the stewards complex and then have to deal with their thing. You know, why? Well, now I know why, because there's some other reasons. But they were trying to create a setting that was going to be really challenging for you to get through, and they had to have some excuse to have something underneath the Lorespire complex, basically. Mm-hmm. Rather than, oh, there's a series of tunnels and sewers you have to get through, they wanted to have something different. So,
right. And variety is important, but I don't know. That puts a lot of implications on what the Starfinder Society does, and mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know that I love that private maintenance of prisons and
Yeah. So anyway, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't kind of put out that way, but that in essence, that's what it, you know, it was an adamantine prison complex type of thing. Anyway, so I just have one more quick question.
Sure.
We have a couple questions, but I think we're running short on time here. So Alex actually asks, what are our favorite rules in the character operation manual? And so I'll go first and I'll give you a chance to think about it. So I actually really like the mechanic prototype armor and prototype weapon aspects of it. So instead of having a drone or having an exocortex, you can have a weapon prototype and an armor prototype. And I've played one of those in an AP, and I just think it's kind of fun. You know, it gives you kind of a really neat flavor that's different than just a straight-up mechanic.
Oh, that is actually kind of – I mean, that's a really good choice, and I think that would be one of my high contenders as well. I've actually got – I'm going to say I'm actually really pleased with a lot of the variety in the spells in the Character Operations Manual. Mm-hmm. And my glib response to the question is going to be, well, obviously the powered armor jockey
yes,
archetype is
of
awesome.
Of course.
Because it's the one that I wrote, and I'm really excited that I got the ability ride or die rig to be something that's formally in the game. But no, I think the spells are really awesome. I took a really close look at a lot of them. Let me tell you, really, one of the co-authors on this is my really good friend Connor, and this was like his first big writing assignment. He was kind of nervous about it. So I actually worked with him to kind of fine-tune a lot of the spells, because he was doing some of the spells, and I worked with him, and I thought he had some great ideas, and I kind of helped him get from the idea to the mechanics part, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And I think that worked really well. But then when I was going through the final product to see how what we had talked about changed, I kept getting distracted by a lot of the other spells and how sort of inherently science fantasy they were. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that you've got spells that let you talk to the planet, and you know, spells that have a that let you get sort of space ghosts into people's weapons and armor and stuff. I mean, that's kind of a really cool. There's a lot of really cool ideas in here. Mm-hmm. I don't know that this made me want to dig sort of right into the Witch Warper, because there's kind of so much cool stuff that even technomancers and mystics can use, mm-hmm. that I thought it was really kind of neat. So I like the spells quite a bit in this book.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, we're kind of at our time stop for today.
But we have more stuff to talk about. I guess that's for episode 14.
Episode 14 for sure. All right. But as always, it's great to have a chance to chat with you again this week, Ron.
Yeah, you too. Always fun.
All right. So I'm John.
And I'm Ron. And this is Digital Divination.